Christmas time. You can see it in everybody. Everybody's eyes are not as red as maybe they are during the September, October, November time period. You can see everybody getting a little healthier. It's like everybody kind of gets younger during Christmas, and we kind of carry that momentum into the new year. I feel the same way. I look in the mirror and I say, "Oh man, look! I'm not. My eyes aren't as red, and I'm a little thicker than I was before the new before Christmas." And then I realize, well, that's not always all a good thing. That thickness is not necessarily what I want. It's because I was making fun of some of the single guys. You know, over Christmas we all work out. We work out really hard. In fact, Brock was talking about this as part of our resolution. We work out what we call very dearly our table muscle over the course of Christmas. It's like a 3 or 4 week workout fest for our table muscle. And we get to about, I get to about this point in the year, and I look at it on the first, and I go, oh, amazing how quickly that table muscle developed with so little time. 4 weeks, promise, guaranteed results in 4 weeks, and I got them. And we all do. We make those promises that we're going to go ahead and we're going to fix that. I kind of told myself this year, I'm not going to worry about reducing the table muscle. I'm just going to try to build up everything around it so everything looks big and it looks smaller in comparison. It's a more positive way of going into the new year as opposed to seeing the youth and the thickness come at the end of this time. And tomorrow, we kind of get started back in for some of us. School starts tomorrow. And I know that they're excited about school starting on this section of the church. Everything starts back up tomorrow morning at 7:30, but I've got to be honest, or 8 o'clock, but I've got to be honest with you, I'm sure the teachers are just as excited that everybody's coming back as those of you who are coming back are excited to be back. And on Monday, all the public schools start back up. Many of you have either started work or about to start back work, and everything is going to pretty quickly go back into the old pattern. In fact, pretty soon, a week or two from now, even though we're writing the wrong dates on the checks, the year 2014 will look very much like 2013 did. Just another date. And I talked about it a few weeks ago, and Brother Brock and Brother Brandon have been talking. Christmas is a time to reflect. And so while we look at Christmas as a time to reflect, I'd like to talk tonight about New Year being a time to decide. It's a time to decide this year whether we're going to spend our life this year, or as that blessing was, are we going to invest our life this year? There's a difference. And in Luke chapter 19, Jesus gives us a parable. And I think in this parable, he paints a picture of the invested life versus the spent life. And in this chapter, Luke chapter 19, the parable starts in verse 11. And most of you know the history of this. He's talking to the Jews or the Israelites right after having led Zacchaeus' family to salvation. And we know the story. He saw Zacchaeus. He was a small man. He climbed a tree. We all know the song. Zacchaeus was a wee little man. And so Jesus Christ said, "Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house today." He went, and he led his family to salvation. We know the story. But the Jews were wroth at the fact that Jesus had gone to have dinner with a sinner. And so they questioned it. And in verse 10, I want you to look at it real quickly in chapter 19, verse 1. It says, "And Jesus entered and passed through Jericho." He was passing through Jericho on his way to Jerusalem. That's where he met Zacchaeus. He passed by, and he was there for a reason. "For the Son of Man," in verse 10, "for the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." And can I tell you, Jesus has not stopped passing through to seek and save that which was lost. And that's what he was telling the Israelites. "I'm passing through here seeking and saving that which was lost, of which Zacchaeus is one." He says, "You've missed the point." And he then gives the parable of the kingdom to explain and put a picture in their minds and ours of what we're to be doing with our lives as we head towards the kingdom. In verse 11, it says, "As they heard these things, he added and spake a parable," because he was nigh to Jerusalem, "and because they thought that the kingdom of God should immediately appear." He's saying, no, the kingdom's not here yet. I'm still seeking, and I'm still saving those which are lost. But what he's saying is that time is going to end. When the kingdom comes, there will no longer be seeking, and there will no longer be saving. But he says, here's what it's going to look like. He says, here's the period in between. And he says, verse 12, he said, "Therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return." And I want to tell us that starting right here, Jesus Christ is painting a picture of our lives. And he's painting a picture and he's saying, you have a choice. You're going to decide. Do you want to spend your life this year, or do you want to invest your life this year? And that nobleman going to the far country is a picture of Jesus. He has left, he has gone to the far country, he has gone home to heaven to receive his kingdom from the Father. And in the meantime, he's left behind two groups of people. In verse 13, we notice he has one group. He called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds. He's got servants. And then verse 14, he's got everybody else. But the citizens, but his citizens hated him and sent a message after him saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. I want us to notice, just on a kind of a side note, that there are two kinds of people Christ has left behind. Those who do not believe in him, those who have rejected him, we met them in verse 14, and then those who are his servants. Notice that there's no in-between. In the book of James, chapter 4, verse 4, it says, you adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. And you can see that picture right here. There's nothing in between. There's those that God is seeking to save. They are currently the enemies of God. We would call them wicked and separated from God. And then there are those who are his servants. And there are no in between. Now we know about those that are not saved. We know about those who, like I said, we would call wicked and separated. We're not going to talk much about them. I want you to keep them in the back of our mind because we're going to come back to them very quickly at the end when we wrap it up. I guess that's one way of knowing when I'm at the end. But we'll come back to them very briefly. I want to focus on that first crew, the verse 13 crew, the servants. Because the servants would be who? Us. He's talking to us, his 10 servants. So I want to look at them, and I want to notice two things, and we'll break it out from in there. But I want us to notice first things, God gave them, Jesus left them with a responsibility. Look at verse 13 with me. He says, and he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and said unto them, occupy till I come. This word occupy means to be busy about his business. Jesus Christ looked at his servants and said, occupy, be about my business until we come. Now, in the military, we use that term occupy to denote when we take something, when we seize something, when we own something. It is when we, figurative, when we have boots on the ground, we occupy an objective. We occupy a piece of terrain. We are physically standing upon it. We have fought for it. We have shot, maybe hurt people in the process of getting it. We have hurt our own people in the process of getting it, and we are now occupying it. There's a picture in our mind. It is not a place that's out there. It's a place that we physically occupy, and on that place we go about our business. In some cases, we might occupy an objective simply to protect it and defend it. Our home is that way. We occupy our home. We don't just dwell there. We occupy it. We defend it ruthlessly against anything outside. I like the picture. Mike told me the story of where he's at. He's on a what we call a FOB, a forward operating base. And it is a small base in the middle of a foreign country. It is occupied by American soldiers and American security forces. They occupy it. They protect it. There's a barrier there. Nobody comes on that base or into that location unless it's okay for them to be there. They don't bring anything in that we don't want in there. What does that sound like? Our homes and our minds. We occupy. We defend. He told a story of a group of enemy folks who tried to infiltrate the base. And on this base, on this FOB, are Rangers and SEALs. Now, their job is not to defend. But as the infiltration began and the security forces fought off the infiltrators, he said those Rangers and those SEALs, they went up on top of the buildings and they absolutely wreaked havoc among everybody out there. Those guys picked a bad target that day because those Rangers and SEALs were ruthlessly defending their occupied territory as we are to ruthlessly defend our homes and our minds. What we let in, who we let in, parents setting an example for our children, how we treat each other, how we treat those around us. Children obeying their parents. We are the movies we watch, the TV shows we watch, the music we listen to. We're to defend, occupy. But notice something. The occupation is just part of it. He says occupy. There's a part that says defend, but there's also a part that denotes going out. When I'm occupying, I am preparing for a purpose. I'm occupying it to defend it and to go out. That would be like my church. I defend my church. It's why standards are so important to a church, because we're defending it. But at the same time, the purpose of the church is to do what? Go out. We're to make a difference in the world. Those rangers and those SEALs that are on that fob with Mike, their job is not specifically to defend that area. They will ruthlessly defend their area, but their mission is to go out and take America out of the fob. Our mission is to take Jesus Christ out, occupy. We're to be about his business. This is where we talk about visitation. It's where we talk about making a difference in our community, in our homes, a difference in our workplace. Are you making a difference? Are you missions, supporting missions, going on missions trips, Sunday schools, Wednesday evenings, we're all here. Again, going out, it's a place of preparation. Jesus Christ says you're to be occupied. I gave you responsibility to be about my business. Those rangers and SEALs, they protect their territory and they go out of that territory. It's why they're there and it's why we're here. We defend. We occupy, we move out. Somebody's got to go out. The pictures, again, of the missionaries as they go out. They are going out, and we are sending. It's a big word. Christ gave a command, and with that, he gave us a responsibility to be about his business until he comes back. And then as he left, I want us to notice the key of it is he gave those servants the tools to occupy. Notice again, verse 13, he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds. You can translate that into 10 opportunities, into tools. Tools he gave them to occupy until he comes. And in verse 15, and it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, that he commanded those servants to be called into him to whom he had given the money. We'll talk about this in a minute. That he might know how much every man had gained by his trading. Remember, there's a responsibility, and there's going to be an accountability. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But I want us to notice he's going to come back, and he's going to ask. And I want us to look at three things he's going to look for when he comes back. What did we do with those tools? Like I said, we're going to see the difference between an invested life and a spent life in the servants. Christ gave us the command. Verse 16 now is the first part. It says, then came the first. This is when the king has now come back, having gained his kingdom. And he's asking for the account. Then came the first, in verse 16, saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 10 pounds. This is the first part. If I'm going to invest my life this year, as this servant did, and not just spend my life, but I'm going to invest my life, it's going to start by focusing on who it is that gave me those tools to begin with and gave me the responsibility. It's going to start with a focus and a fervency. First part is focus. Go with me real quickly, if you would, to Acts chapter 18. I like the picture of this man. Acts chapter 18. We're to be about his business. Acts 18, verse 24, we get introduced. And a certain Jew, Acts 18, verse 24, named Apollos, born at Alexandria, an eloquent man and mighty in the scriptures, came to Ephesus. I want you to notice this man was given a talent by God. He was given tools by God. He was given time by God. He was given a memory. He was given a mighty skill. But I want you to notice that skill was worthless in his own hands until we see verse 25. This man was instructed in the way of the Lord. I want you to notice step one was to become focused and dedicated to the Lord. Step one of focus is being dedicated to the Lord. He had some great tools, but they were worthless until God got hold of them. Verse 25. This man was instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in the Spirit, he spake and taught diligently the things of the Lord, knowing only the baptism of John. I'm telling you, the first part of being focused is being dedicated to the one that gave you those tools, that time, this year. Can I tell you, we talk about the military, and I keep going back to the military, but we call them dedicated. If we look at their life, they suffer hunger. Those soldiers suffer want. They stay in the rain, in the cold, in the heat. They're separated from home for 6, 8, 12, 14 months at a time. The only way they talk to their family is through Skype. They jump out of airplanes. They get shot at. They get maimed. They get killed. And we say these people are dedicated to their country. How much more should a Christian be dedicated to our country? It should see. We say they have dedicated their talents and their youth and their life to their country. Christian, are we dedicated to the one that gave us the tools to be about his business? That's the first part of being focused. There should be a dedication there in our lives. Notice also that this young man, once he got, again, the man was instructed in the way of the Lord. Once he got that, he became fervent in the spirit. He spake and taught diligently. That's the second part of being focused. If I'm to be focused this year, if I'm going to be fervent this year, I'm going to be dedicated to the one that gave me those tools, and I'm going to be diligent for the one that gave me those tools. Diligently means hardworking and persistent. I like the picture. Are we diligent? Are we hardworking and persistent in reading our Bible every day, even if we're not getting anything out of it? Are we hardworking and persistent? Are we dedicated? Are we diligent in our prayer for the saints and those around us? Are we diligent in trying to be here whenever the doors are open? It's diligence. It's an investment. We may have done it last year. We may not. Those are investments. Those are being diligent. Are we diligent in visitation and getting the gospel out to those around us? Do those at work know exactly who we are and who our Father is? Do those in school? I know we get a lot of us go to a Christian school, but I can promise you, not every child in this school is saved. And not every child in the school has parents that are saved. Do they know where we stand? Are we diligent? Are we hardworking and persistent in those areas? This man became diligent, hardworking and persistent in working for his Father, in working for the Lord. So be focused means I'm dedicated, I'm diligent, and lastly, it means I'm determined. Go with me to the book of Deuteronomy real quickly. I asked you a question. I talked about this a while back. I asked you a question. Everybody remembers the story of the golden calf, and I love the picture of the golden calf. Now, we know the story. Moses up the mountain, and he is getting the Ten Commandments from the Father himself. He has left Aaron in charge, but let me tell you, God is the one that selected Aaron and made Aaron the priest. God is the one that left Aaron in charge of the Israelites. God is the one that gave Aaron the responsibility for what the Israelites were doing. Yet it was Aaron that told the Israelites to give him the earrings. It was Aaron that put the golden earrings into the fire. It was Aaron that molded the golden calf. And it was Aaron that told everybody to worship the golden calf. It was the priest of God that did it. And when God came, he killed 3,000 Israelites and did not kill who? Aaron. Why? Of all people, the first one to suffer God's wrath should have been Aaron. And most of us know this, but it's just a reminder to us. In Deuteronomy 9, verse 18, 19, and 20, we see the answer as to why. Why is it 3,000 Israelites were killed, but Aaron, the one who led it and was given the responsibility to prevent it, was not? It says, "And I fell down, I being Moses, before the Lord, as at the first, 40 days and 40 nights. I did neither eat bread nor drink water because of all your sins, which ye sinned in doing wickedly in the sight of the Lord, to provoke him to anger. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure wherewith the Lord was wroth against you to destroy you. But the Lord hearkened unto me at that time also. And the Lord was very angry with who? Say it with me. Aaron. To have what? And I prayed for Aaron at the same time." Would you say that this qualifies as a determined prayer? Would you say this qualifies as a man determined to serve his master? And I wonder if that right there describes our prayer life for those around us. I've got to be blatantly honest with you. I can look at that passage and say, I wish I could pray that strongly. I'm not determined enough. that's determination. If we're to be focused, there's a dedication of my tools to the Lord, the one who gave them to me. There's a diligence, a hard working in serving him. And there's a determination to serve him at all costs. Does that describe us as we go into the new year? There's a focus. Second, I want you to notice about those men. Verse 17, back in the chapter of Luke. Back in the book of Luke, chapter 19. They had a focus. Thy pound. They were fervent about thy, their master. I want you to notice, second, they were focused and they were faithful. Verse 17, he said unto him, remember verse 16, then came the first, saying, Lord, thy pound is gained 10 pounds. And he, being Jesus, said unto him, well, thou good servant, because thou hast been faithful in a very little, thou have authority over 10 cities. Faithful is the second one. Faithful, described in the Bible, and this word means trustworthy, sure, and true. To make it easier for us, I'll say that faithful means we're wise, we're worthy, and we're weary of where we're going. We're wise. Go with me to Ephesians 5 real quickly, if you could. Ephesians chapter 5. Walking faithfully. Pastors talked about this chapter wonderfully. Ephesians chapter 5. In verse 15, it says, wherefore, and I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong chapter, forgive me. Ephesians 5, verse 15, it says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. I like the picture. We're to walk wisely. I want to understand that as we look at the men with the talent, let me walk through that real quickly. Each man, each servant stood in front of Christ. Christ had given each one of them a tool. Just as Christ has given every one of us tools, he's given us a certain amount of time, he's given us certain gifts, he's given us talents, he's given us money, he's given us energy, he's given us tools. And every servant stood in front of God to report on his use of those tools. And just like those servants, every one of us will stand in front of God to report on our use of our tools. But I want us to notice that in Luke chapter 19, don't go there, they were not asked about the tools of the others. The faithful man was not asked to report on the status of the pounds Christ gave to the unfaithful man, because it was not his to worry about. The faithful man, each man reported on the tools that were given to him. And every one of us is only going to report on the tools that were given to us. And we've got to be careful. We've got to walk wisely, because sometimes we're so focused on what others are not doing that we miss what it is that we are supposed to be doing. We've got to walk wisely, God says. Wisely. You've got to identify what it is he's asked you to do. Can I tell you, God has not asked you to fix everything that's broken at your place of work. God has not asked you to fix everything that is broken in your church, if there is anything broken. I'd be careful with that. God has not asked you to fix everything that is broken in your family. God has asked you, God has given you a command to make a difference in every single one of those areas. And the question is, are we making a difference? Are we walking wisely? I like the picture because I think teenagers, I talk to teenagers about it every now and then. The Bible does not tell you, despite our desire, the Bible does not tell you to fix your parents. It does not tell you to correct your parents. It tells you to do what? Honor and obey your parents. Husbands, the Bible does not tell you that you must fix your wife. It does not tell you that you are to correct your wife. It tells you that you are to love your wife and lead your wife, to set an example for your wife. There's a big difference. Wives, the Bible does not tell us to correct our husbands. It tells us to reverence our husbands. There's a big difference. Sometimes we get so focused on what others are not doing that we miss what it is God has said we're supposed to be doing. He says, walk wisely. If you're to walk faithfully, identify what it is I have told you to do and do that. Those are the things. It's walking wisely. Second, you've got to walk worthily. Look at the second part of the same scripture right there. The word walk. It says, see then that you walk circumspectly. The word walk is used 212 times in the Bible. It denotes moving from point A to point B. Pastor gave a great illustration of this, walking circumspectly as a tightrope walker. He walks on a rope circumspectly, one foot in front of the other, and he's got to be careful to stay worthy, to stay sure of his footing. Why? He's not walking on it to walk on it. He's walking on it to go from point A to point B. And every one of us has to walk wisely, and we have to walk worthily. Identify what it is God has told you to do and use your tools the right way, in a way that honors the Lord. Let me give you an example. Again, the picture of the SEALs and the Rangers over with Mike. I like the picture. I didn't have to tell you what they did in the attack. Because in all honesty, every single person in this room knows that you hear the word Rangers and you hear the word SEALs, and automatically you know that, boy, I bet those guys did a lot of damage. Because I know who they are. You know them by reputation. But if I told you at the end of the story that those guys got up there and they only hit about half of what they shot at, and only about half of them was even able to get their weapons into operation because their weapons weren't ready, you would be extremely disappointed. You would think, what? How's that possible? These are Rangers and SEALs. I put them up there. If I told you that they missed half and they couldn't even operate the weapons they were given, you would be tremendously disappointed in what you were hearing. And I wonder how disappointed Jesus Christ is in one of us that does not use the tools the way he gave it. A child of great intelligence that comes home with B's and C's. I wonder how disappointed Christ is with the child he gave that intelligence to. I love the picture. Now, my son, like some of the other guys here, has got a great sense of humor. He is very funny. Isaac is. He can make me laugh. There's a lot of guys here. Rio can make me laugh. There's a lot of guys here who can make me laugh a lot very quickly and very easily. They've got a great sense of humor. God gave them that sense of humor. It's a tremendous tool God will use someday in their lives and the lives of those around them. And I'm not picking on those two at all. But I want to paint a picture. If that child that God gave this great sense of humor to is then known as a goofball by his friends and by his teachers, how disappointed is God in that child who he gave the tools to? Husbands and wives, I was talking to Patty about this the other day. I do not enjoy driving in traffic. I drive a one-ton truck. I do not enjoy traffic. And I notice that around here people drive very erratically and very slowly. And I do not like driving slowly. I drive to the gap. I can't remember who was telling me that. I think. And sometimes that anger will come out. And I'll say something like, why don't they just get a bike and ride the bike? They're going slow enough anyway. That way the rest of us who want to get somewhere can go. But how disappointed are my children when I am teaching them about patience and a love for others when they hear me talk in traffic? How disappointed are they? How disappointed is my father? Parents, how disappointed are our children when we teach them not to bicker, and we bicker with each other? Can I tell you, there's a disappointment there. How disappointing is it at work when instead of being a pillar of strength that relies on our Father, we have bad days, we have bad attitudes, we're short with our coworkers or our boss, we don't produce good work? How disappointing is that to the world around us that expects so much? See, we're not taking the tools God gave us and using them worthily. We have to use them wisely, identify what it is God has given you to do, and then you have to use it worthily in a way that honors the Lord. Or it's not going to work very well for us. We're not investing our life, we're spending our life. And then thirdly, being faithful means I walk wisely, I walk worthily, and then still in Ephesians chapter 5, now verse 16, it says, redeeming the time because the days are evil. We got to walk warily. We got to walk weary and understand that Satan is going to try to pull us from doing the right thing. I like the picture that Paul is painting, because Satan wants to keep us too busy to do our devotions, because he knows if he keeps us from that, we can't walk worthily. Satan wants to distract us with what everybody else is not doing so that we don't get focused on what it is we should be doing, because we're focused on them. Satan would love to convince us that you can do something tomorrow that you should do today. But God does not promise that that person you didn't witness to will have a tomorrow. Nor does God promise that the problem your child or your wife or your husband tries to talk to you about today will not be compounded and worse tomorrow. He says, redeem the time. Walk warily. Understand Satan is going to try to distract you from it. Make the time to do what God has asked you to do. And don't allow him to distract you from it. He's going to try to keep you from coming to church when it's the very place Jesus has told you to come. And can I tell you something else Satan will convince you of if you don't walk weary? He'll convince you that good enough is good enough. And the honest fact is, good enough is not good enough. Only our best is good enough. B's and C's are not good enough. If that's all you got, it's all you got. But for most of us, it's not good enough. An okay husband is not good enough. A good enough product is not good enough. It is not walking wisely. It's not working worthily. And it's not walking wearily. We're not faithful in the things Christ has given us. Using our talents and our gifts, our tools faithfully, means using them the way God intended, in the place he intended, to serve those he gave you this year. If we're to invest our lives this year, we have to use those tools. So we've got to walk, we've got to be focused, we've got to be faithful, and then finally, we've got to be fruitful. Look again at those servants back in the book of Luke. Notice again verse 16, the first servant gained 10 pounds. He says, then came the first, I'm in Luke 19 again, verse 16, came the first saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 10 pounds. And he, being Christ, said unto him, well, thou good servant, because thou hast been faithful in a very little, hath thou authority over 10 cities. And the second, verse 18, came, saying, Lord, thy pound has gained 5 pounds. And he said, likewise to him, be thou also 5 cities. I want you to notice that the Lord was pleased with both of them. Why? Because they brought a return on his investment. They were fruitful. Christ said, I gave you the tool when I left. And can I tell you? Jesus Christ invested everything in us. We are his investment. And he gave all of it for us. And when he comes back, he expects a return on that investment, just as he did with them. Remember what he said in verse 15? He came back to see what they had done with the pound he had given them. And can I tell you, he was pleased with those that brought a return. Luke 6, verse 44 says, for every tree is known by his fruit. For of thorns men do not gather figs, nor of a bramble bush gather they grapes. If we are investing, there will be a fruit. If there's no fruit, then we've got to consider we may not be investing. Can I tell you real quickly, go to Galatians chapter 5. We won't go through these. I'll just read them. We'll read them together, and then we don't have time to cover them. But let me just read you some of the fruits. If we're walking with a focus, if we're faithful, then we should be fruitful. We should see this. This should describe us. Galatians 5, starting at verse 22. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. And they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. So those are supposed to be gone. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. And let us not be desirous of vainglory, provoking one another, envying one another. That, we don't have time to cover it, but that is supposed to be our fruit. And my question is, how many of us in this room are known for those things listed right there? And if we're not known for them, then I guess this year, every one of us has some fruit we can still work on. But I want to ask you further. Parents, have you ever listened to your children argue? Anybody? In that mirror, if you look at them arguing, if we're wise, we'll look at that mirror and realize, as they're bickering, who do they sound like? They sound just like us. When we're driving in traffic, or when we're walking around, or when we're home when we're tired. Parents, if we want to see our fruit, look at our kids. Teens, your fruit, where we describe what you should look like. But let me ask you this. How do your friends look? I told you, There's people in the school that go to school with you every day that are not saved. How many of them are going to be in heaven with you? What do your friends look like? There's your fruit, because they are, again, as Christ said, fruitful. Folks, what do your coworkers look like? There should be a marked difference between what your works look like, what your work looked like before you were there, and what it looks like now that you're there. Teachers, what do your children look like? Some of you have more contact hour with some of these kids than their parents do. Do they look like you? What's the fruit? Christ says they were fruitful. If we're fruitful, that means that when I get to heaven, I'm going to see a lot of people that I made a difference in. Whether I got to lead them to Christ or not, I made a difference in their life. There's a fruit, not here, but in heaven. And can that be seen in my life? Notice they were fervent, they were focused, they were faithful, and they were fruitful. There was an indicator in their life. And then I want to close with this last part, because we said there's responsibility. God gave us responsibility because there's going to be an accountability. I like the picture in verse 15. And I want to remind us real quickly that those rangers and seals we talk about, they didn't wake up one morning and realize, I'm a ranger. They didn't wake up on Monday morning and become a ranger. They didn't wake up on Tuesday morning and became a SEAL. Every one of those soldiers, every one of those people made a decision. They made a decision going in, and they made a decision every day that this is something they are going to do. It was a matter of choice. You know, at the entry to Ranger School, I don't know if it's still there, but it used to be there. There was a sign, silly, but it was there. It said, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. It's foolish. I don't even know, they put it there because it scares young men like me coming in. Because before I go in through that gate where there's a sign that says, abandon hope, all you who come here, and while 330 or 40 are coming in, only 33 are going to graduate, going in there I have to make a choice. Do I really want to do this? I don't have to. I can be an Army officer and not do this. I'm here. I have to make a choice. It's a choice to go in. And then it's a choice to stay in. And every one of those Rangers and every one of those SEALs makes a choice. And every Christian has to make a choice. Do I really want to go in there? Do I want to invest my life this year? And then every day this year, I'm going to have to make a choice to stay in there and keep investing my life. Because I want to look real quick. Christ says there's going to be an accountability. He says, and it came to pass, verse 15, that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded those servants to be called unto him, to whom he had given the money, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. Now jump down real quick to verse 27, because we saw the servants, two of them. And then in verse 27, I said earlier that there were two types of people. Now you know I'm getting close to the end. I said there's two types of people. There are those who are the servants, and there was everybody else. Everybody else are those that Christ is trying to seek, and he's trying to save. Using who? His servants. And in verse 27, we find out what happens to them. But those mine enemies, those being the citizens, those who are not saved, which would not that I should reign over them, bring hither and slay them before me. This is those people that did not accept him. These are those that we would call wicked because they rejected him. We know that. It's so clear and it's so easy. But I want us to notice that they were then slayed. The servants were welcomed home, right? Except for one. Verse 19, and he said likewise to him, be thou also over five cities, is that third servant. And another came, saying, Lord, behold, here is thy pound, which I have kept laid up in a napkin, for I feared thee, because thou art an austere man. And verse 22, and he said unto him, out of thine own mouth will I judge thee. And somebody tell me what he calls him. Thou, what? Wicked servant. And I want that picture because we cannot run from the scripture. Jonah tried, it didn't work out very well for him. That term wicked, we use it to describe those that rejected Christ, and it's accurate. But I want us to notice who Christ used it to describe. He didn't use it to describe those who had rejected him. He used it to describe those servants that did not use the tools he gave them properly. That's who he used that against. And can I tell you something? I can't run from that scripture no matter how hard I try. What Christ is saying is you don't want to be that guy. Yes, you're coming home, but you don't want to be the guy I call wicked because you've not used the tools I gave you to be about my business. I told the teens the story a while back, and they may remember it. We were in Panama, and we had just finished looking for a downed aircraft, World War II aircraft, and we were in the middle of nowhere, and one of my soldiers got lost. He wandered off, and we'd been out there for about 10 days, and so they call in all kinds of reinforcements to go find him, and we spent about 3 days looking for him. And if you get lost in the jungle, literally, if you walk out there at night without a compass, you're probably going to get lost, and he did. He was a great navigator, but he managed to lose himself. And it turns out that in his wanderings, where he probably would have died, he got to a place in the middle, literally, we are in the mountains of Panama with triple canopy jungle. He gets to a home, a little thatch hut in the middle of nowhere next to a creek bed where some Indians live, a little Indian family. And they took him in, and they fed him, and took care of him for the 3 days while we're circling all over the place frantically trying to find him. Now, we got there, and I got the radio call. It had taken me this day about 8 to 12 hours to get down this mountain through some miserable terrain to get to near to where he was. And I got the call over the radio that they have found him and this is where he is. I got the grid coordinates. So I headed over there. In the meantime, and I have a section of my scouts with me. In the meantime, others have gotten there and a couple guys have gotten hurt in the process of trying to find him. So we get to these people's place. Now they have a beautiful little spot right by the creek with a banana plantation. They have banana plants. They have trees everywhere that they use for their living. And it's right up against a mountain, so there's no place to bring an aircraft. But going up that mountain, partway up is a little small plateau. So it was big enough not to land a helicopter on, but we were able to bring the helicopters in so they could put the front two wheels on the edge with the back end hanging off the cliff. And he would stay there on full power, and guys could crawl down the mountain and get into the sides. Now, we had a lot of soldiers stranded out here. It was getting late. We had been literally 10 to 12 hours getting here. It's nowhere thing but up, and I knew we were not going to get back. We'd be out of radio communication. I had no choice. I needed aircraft to get me out. We brought the aircraft in to medevac the guys that were hurt. We brought the aircraft in to medevac this guy who had been lost. Now, I'm stranded with my soldiers, and I'm calling aircraft in to get us out. And every one of them comes in, and the pilots bring those aircraft in, and we had to vector them in between the trees. They put those front wheels on the flat spot. That back tail is hanging over the edge. They've got the rotors up on full power to keep them there as we try to crawl guys in. We brought in several waves of aircraft trying to get everybody out. On the last load, I've got all my soldiers. I had seen the little Panamanian family as I came in, but I since then had not seen them. And I crawl to the aircraft, and I get in, and I crawl in, and I sit in the seat, and the crew chief grabs me by the shoulder and shakes me, says, "You got to see this." So I said, "Fine." I put on the headset, and as he's backing out, now he can't go forward because he's got a mountain there. So he's backing up and going up, and I notice he's going kind of slow, and he's shifting over to the right. And as he's going, I'm sitting right at the door, and I'm looking, and I see the house, the little straw house of the Indian family. And standing on their foot, and I see the roof, just, you know, because it's just straw, from the helicopter blades. And he's shifting left, trying to get the pressure off the house. And I see the family, they're standing there waving at me. They're so sweet. And I said, "That's really cool." And he said, and the crew chief said, no. I said, "That's cool. They're waving. I didn't get a chance to say bye." He says, "Look." And I said, "What?" And so he grabbed the pilot and he said, "Shift." So the pilot kept shifting right, left. He kept shifting left. And as he raised up and turned, I looked. And you know what I saw? Their entire field of banana plants had been destroyed. Our helicopters coming in without realizing it had ruined their fields. And I lost my mind. I grabbed that crew chief. I was trying to crawl over him to the pilot. Now, don't get upset. The State Department goes back in and takes care of that. But and we did get the word to them. But I went by, I'm crawling over the crew chief trying to get to the pilot, screaming, "We've got to go back. Who's got some money on them? Give me something, anything. Let's go. Let's go back. We're going back. And I'm shaking the crew chief, literally. He's trying to sit me in my seat. I'm trying to grab the pilots, and I'm screaming at them, go back, go back, go back, go down. I was desperate. Something. We've got to say thank you. We've got to give them something in return for what they've given me. They saved my soldier's life. Go down. And the pilot said, negative, we cannot. We'll blow the roof off. We've got to get out of here. I said, we have to do something. I was desperate to do something for them. Desperate. And I look at that picture of me in that aircraft, literally grabbing people by the throat, trying to pull them to get them to go back down, trying to grab money from whoever I could to try to go down and say thank you. And yet, my Savior, who died on the cross, who gave me a gift no less precious than that, am I that desperate to do something to say thank you for him when he's the one who told me, I expect you to do it for me? Those people waving on the porch did nothing to deserve what had happened to them. And Jesus Christ did nothing to deserve what had happened to them, to him. They did it on our account. And he did it for our account. And he said, occupy, be about my business. He said, I'm giving you the tools. And this year, as we go into the new year, as every year, we've got to ask ourselves, are you going to spend your life? Or are we going to invest our life so that we have something to give the Father when he comes back that says, thank you. Thank you for what you did for me and on my behalf. I know that I've, for one, absolutely have to learn to invest my life. I want to walk more wisely. I want to walk more worthily. I want to walk more wearily. I want to be focused. I want to be faithful, and I want to be fruitful. Because if my Father comes back next June, if he comes back next August, I want to know that I was desperate to do something for him. As desperate as I was to get that helicopter back down, I want to be that desperate for Jesus Christ. So as we go into the new year, just a small challenge with every head bowed and every eye closed, can I ask you, as we go into 2014, as 2013 is closed, the chapter of 2014 opens, as we go, and pretty soon, this chapter might look like the last one. But can I challenge us? Will we go into this year focused on serving, focused on investing our life for Jesus Christ, and not just spending it? Brother Brock talked about this year is so much different than last year. It's different this year because of what he invested this year. If we don't invest, there will be no difference at the end of next year. With every head bowed and every eye closed, maybe we haven't invested our life the way we want to in 2013. I can't say whether we have or not. I look at those descriptions and I know I have not. I can do some things better. I wasn't always as focused as I needed to be. I dropped off a little bit in my dedication. May we drop off in our diligence or our determination to serve the Father and to pray. May we drop off in our diligence in studying. May we weren't as faithful as we needed to be, focused on others more than focused on what I was supposed to be doing. Maybe I wasn't worthy in walking and using my tools worthily for the Lord and wasn't wary of what Satan was trying to do to pull me away from it. Maybe we didn't produce the fruit we would like to have produced, and this year we want to do better. Or maybe we did very well last year. Maybe we invested like we should have this last year. And this year God says, now I want you to invest more. There are these people in your life I want you to invest in. There are these things, new opportunities God has placed in our lives to invest in. Whatever your need is, can I ask you? Will you spend some time with the Lord, and will you tell him, Lord, this year, I want to invest my life, not spend it. Just take some time in prayer as the piano plays.